Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Today on the show, Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney talks about the importance of following health orders when it comes to COVID-19.
This is a very serious and, deadly virus. And I think it's important that we take it seriously. We're now over 90,000 Americans have died.
Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks partially reopened this week, and a longtime National Park Service employee expects a trial-and-error approach.
How is it going? How is it working? Are there challenges? What's working well? What's maybe not working?
We'll also hear from members of the Wheeler family of Etherty, who lost three loved ones on a single day to COVID-19.
This is just the ugliest thing a family can go through.
Those stories and more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney has been urging people to social distance and to follow health orders ever since COVID-19 became an issue in this country. This sets her apart from some of her Republican colleagues. She joins us to discuss COVID-19 and what we might expect in the future. Well, Representative Cheney, first off, thank you so much for taking time to visit with us. You know, I've been interested. I've been following you for years, of course, on social media like everybody else has. And, on this COVID-19 issue, you've been very consistent, very concerned about people doing the right things, washing their hands, social distancing and all that. And I guess the only reason I find that notable is I don't see every politician doing the same kind of thing. Have you felt that that was an important thing to do?
I have, Bob, and I think, first of all, thanks for having me on today. I appreciate it. And look, I think that what we have seen is that this is a very serious and deadly virus. And I think it's important that we take it seriously. We're now over 90,000 Americans have died. I think that one of the things that is really a real attribute of our system in the United States is that at the end of the day, the decisions about how our communities respond to the virus really is something where the decisions are made, at the state and local levels. And I've been very supportive of what Governor Gordon has been doing. I think that it makes complete practical sense that the rules for us in Wyoming will be different than the rules that are being put in place in places like California and New York. But I think it's important for us to be very cautious and very careful and recognize that we're making huge strides towards therapeutics. Fast progress towards vaccines, we need to be sure that we continue to do that, and that's sort of what Congress stays focused on while people undertake all of the guidance that we've seen in terms of social distancing and what you mentioned, hand washing and crowd size, things like that, so we can keep people safe.
Yeah, it's been interesting. I guess I shouldn't be surprised in this day and age that everything does become political, but even this has become very political on safety issues, which has surprised me. I've been just amazed by, here's some good, solid safety advice for you, and that turned into a partisan issue. I mean, what has been your thoughts on our response here in Wyoming to maybe even closing businesses? Was that a good idea for at least a while?
I do think it was necessary, and I think that we have to make assessments and we have to make judgments. We have to balance the risk that people might have to take. I think that what we have also recognized is the huge economic devastation that has come across the board. When you look at the unemployment numbers for the whole country, certainly, when you look at the impact it has when an economy just comes to a complete standstill. Now, I think if we had not taken those steps, that we would have seen far greater deaths. And the real concern was always that you'd end up in a situation where the healthcare system couldn't support the people who were sick. Now, for us in Wyoming, we've had a different problem in a number of places, which is that, you know, we stopped elective surgery and did not have the numbers of COVID cases. And so obviously some of our local hospitals, some of the rural hospitals have been affected economically by not being able to do elective surgery and also not having any COVID patients. So Mike Enzi and John Barrasso and I have been working very hard here in Washington to make sure that the resources that we're providing for the hospitals, for example, can be targeted towards our rural hospitals. We've also made sure, you know, as you're looking at things like the program that's provided loans for small businesses, we've had over 12,000 businesses across Wyoming able to get access to those funds. You know, similarly with the EIDL insurance programs, it's been important for us to make sure that there are resources that people can take advantage of and can get access to help while we get through this economic crisis, because it is an economic crisis as well as a public health crisis.
Representative Liz Cheney visiting with us. We were talking before we started here about our legislature passing some legislation for handing out some of the CARES Act funding, which obviously was critical. I mean, one of the things that's really interesting here is, though, we had to do something for some of the states, but it seems like there's going to be a comeuppance at some point. Is there a concern that, you know, we're trying to bail states out at the same time there's going to be some tough decisions all of us are going to have to make, isn't there?
Well, certainly in terms of you know, bailing states out, I think it's really important that we not go down the path where, you know, states like ours end up on the hook for bailing out states that have not made good fiscal decisions, responsible economic decisions. And I think that's why you've seen with this latest piece of legislation that passed the House of Representatives on Friday, and it passed, I think, with only one Republican vote, and you know, all the Democrats, or not maybe most of the Democrats, you know, and that really was it's a $3 trillion package of new spending that didn't go through a single committee hearing and isn't going to go any place in the Senate. And part of the reason is because of you know, the resources that would be required to bail out states that you know, as I said, have not been responsible. So I think the way that we look at this in terms of the delegation, the way that I look at it is the immediate emergency relief has been really important for people. And it's been really important to help keep people employed. It's been important to help our businesses be able to stay functioning and our small business owners not have to, you know, go under. But we need to look at it as temporary. And the real solution here is to get the economy going again, to get to a place where we have testing and treatment and ultimately a vaccine, although we're not saying you have to wait for that, so that the economy itself can start functioning again. And we don't want to be in a position where these programs become permanent, because you know, that would be really devastating economically for the nation as a whole.
What is the view from the federal government? What are you being told? What can we expect in the fall and winter? I mean, what's it look like? Optimistic or not?
People are optimistic. I think that because we've been able to make progress in terms of getting testing supplies out more broadly, and looking at, you know, how we've all sort of become accustomed to operating, I think, you know, people are hopeful that we'll be able to open up here. I think there are different assessments about what's going to happen in the fall in terms of whether or not the virus is going to sort of have a resurgence and come back. And I think that, you know, that may be entirely possible. But we'll have to see what happens. I also think, though, that if it does sort of have a resurgence in the fall, we'll be in a different place in terms of therapies and treatments by then, and we'll be better able to handle it because we will know more. And I also think it's important to remember who's to blame here.
Yeah, I was going to let you have a chance to talk about that. You're on this committee that's looking into China. Why is this important to blame them?
Well, it's important to hold them accountable. I think that what clearly happened, you know, you can set aside all of the discussions and debates about whether the virus came out of the wet market in Wuhan, whether it came out of a lab in Wuhan. It came from Wuhan. And it also, we know that the government of China knew that they had human-to-human transmission. They did not tell the world that. They hid that from the world. And then they shut down travel from Wuhan into the rest of the country while they allowed travel from Wuhan into the rest of the world. And that, you know, to me, that is the key issue. And that's the key moment at which they were very clearly culpable. And, you can't say that it was accidental because they took such clear steps to protect themselves. So I think that it is very important for us, given the devastation this virus has caused, given the lives it's taken, and I'm sure that it's far more globally than we're seeing reported, that, you know, this can't happen again. And any country that would do what the Chinese government has done has got to be held accountable for that. And I think we also have to make sure we protect ourselves. We can't allow, the Chinese government, knowing their intention and knowing what they're willing and capable to do, we can't allow them to control, for example, our supply chains of critical pharmaceuticals or defense-related products, other things that we need to protect ourselves. We can't be in a position where they can blackmail us.
Do we also need to do a better job of being ready for something like this?
I do think that it's important. I think that we absolutely have to look at, the lessons that we're learning from this experience. I think that, whenever you go through a crisis, it's important to do lessons learned. And I think we do need to make sure that we're taking every step necessary to protect ourselves from, biohazards, from future pandemics, and making sure that we've acted responsibly.
Representative Cheney, it's always nice talking to you. Thank you for making time for us.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Bob. Appreciate it.
When we come back, we'll hear about a proposal to develop some mobile health facilities, and we will remember a longtime Jackson resident who was a coronavirus victim. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. You've probably heard all about companies stepping up to help deal with the COVID-19 crisis. In that vein, a military contractor in Pinedale that normally designs products and services for government is now manufacturing mobile hospital rooms using shipping containers. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards spoke with Enviromedial Services President Jeff Keough and the company's sales director, Sam Sumrall. Keough explains that the Army Corps of Engineers put out a request for designs for a movable quarantine space.
They felt that there was a lot of areas in the United States that have basic clinics that don't have areas where they could house someone who could possibly have COVID for an extended period during the testing process and during the results process. So we were commissioned by them to look into and come up with a rapid prototype of it. So we started with 45-foot ISO shipping containers, which are in and of themselves extremely durable and made to be transported via rail or via truck. So a local, state, or federal government can purchase these and be able to transport them wherever it needed to be. So we start with a raw container, and then we turn it into a three-room medical facility with negative pressure, with all the requirements of an actual hospital room. So it would have an oxygen port. It has all the required outlets per federal standards for hospitalization rooms and a bathroom wash sinks for the healthcare workers and for the patient.
This is Sam. If a state entity purchased one of these or multiple ones of these, it might be used to address COVID-19 right now. But once that threat was over, they could simply be mothballed and utilized for another threat down the road where some type of isolation was required. So there's a lot of flexibility that goes into this that you don't have with a temporary facility such as a tent. So we could set one of these units in a rural county situation where they're far removed from a hospital. There may be a small medical clinic or like an inn reservation. If an infected person goes into that type of a medical clinic, then the risk is infecting everybody in there. Well, if we have one of our units sitting out beside the clinic that is relegated to nothing but initial examination, then that prevents the spike.
And so what has the response been? Does it seem like people are requesting them, and where are they ending up?
I think the first order we're going to see is probably looks like it's headed to the Wind River Indian Reservation in Wyoming. Army Corps of Engineers has a sources sought out for 250 of them, and then Sam just found yesterday Homeland Security has a questionnaire going out right now as well.
The government is already deeply concerned about the second wave of the virus, and they're even talking about a third wave and the fact that it's going to be 18 months before a vaccine is ready. I think that we're just on the cusp of getting orders from a number of sources.
So how did you guys end up in Pinedale, Wyoming? So
we've been manufacturing all our equipment that we built for the United States military in California for almost 20 years. Sam and I had both relocated here 6 or 7 years ago, and we immediately noticed the workforce and the quality of the workforce up in Wyoming was far greater than what I was able to achieve in California. And between the local regulations of California, the extreme expensive facilities, and it just wasn't conducive to have a great work environment with really high-quality people working in our manufacturing facility. So, you know, having a small community where the county commissioners for Sublette County have been nothing but supportive, you know, they have a real interest in what we do. You know, the small community allows a great environment to manufacture in.
And how many people are you employing there?
We've got 14 right now in Pinedale on a full-time basis. And what we've done is, you know, we've morphed from just straight manufacturing in Pinedale to running a lot of our operations out of here. So if the containers start to take off, we're anticipating possibly another 40 people very, very quickly. And here, that is easy. I could have 40 high-quality people signed up in a couple of days. So in the first month, we'll be able to produce 15 a month. And within 45 days, we're planned and ready to gear up to do almost one a day. I think part of the reopening of America is that they feel that they want the states and local communities to have the tools and resources to be able to handle spikes. And I know that's a huge concern. As we reopen, are they going to start seeing spikes here in different places in the United States? And how are they going to be able to handle a spike and contain it so it doesn't turn into another outbreak? And part of these containers are that. If they start to see it, they have places where they can quarantine and keep people separate instead of putting them in their hospitals in these rural communities that aren't set up for quarantine centers, and it's one of the tools they're going to need to be able to reopen confidently and safely.
Well, thank you, guys. This has been so interesting.
Thanks again. Well, have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards speaking with Environmental Services President Jeff Keough and the sales director, Sam Sumrall, about their new mobile hospital units. The Mountain West News Bureau is talking to friends and relatives of those who've lost their lives to COVID-19. Today, Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen has this memorial of Bill Sweeney, who moved to Jackson from the mountains.
Sam Sweeney says he started to worry about his dad, Bill, when he didn't hear from him for a few days.
He, like, hasn't called It was strange. Like, I texted him and he didn't text back, and usually he's a pretty avid text messenger.
Bill had tested positive for COVID-19 back in March and was at home self-isolating. Sam and his two siblings live out in California, so a welfare nurse was checking up on Bill every so often. When Sam didn't hear back from his dad, he called the local hospital. He learned his dad had been admitted.
Almost right away, the doctors there told me that he should be airbagged to Idaho Falls, just because they had, I guess, the equipment they thought he needed.
From there, things got worse. And at the age of 71 on April 22nd, Bill died. It was Earth Day.
He would have enjoyed that irony.
That's Bill's younger brother, John. He says Bill absolutely loved nature.
The wilderness, the vistas, the people, the relationships that he built. You know, Wyoming was where his heart and soul belonged.
He was born in Minnesota, then grew up in Massachusetts. But his first experience of Wyoming was as a teenager, when he and two of his brothers attended the National Outdoor Leadership School.
Bill really took it to heart and took a lot of the National Outdoor Leadership School courses, and through those connections and adventures, climbed Alaska's Mount McKinley all the way to the summit, and was very proud of that accomplishment.
Bill would go on to become a filmmaker, mostly producing documentaries about the natural world, even earning himself an Emmy for his work on Ted Turner's Portrait of America series. John says his brother's storytelling ability not only made him a great filmmaker, but a good companion, too.
My brother could make a friend with anyone, and did, and it wasn't an effort for him. He just always assumed the best of you and wanted to know who you were and what you were about.
That zest for people and life took him all over the world, as he worked as a private pilot as well. His nephew, Ben Batchelder, says he came to visit him a few years ago, all the way in Brazil.
He had a really warm soul and somewhat fearless. And so he seemed to go to a lot of places up until his very last year. So he was not someone to let the grass grow beneath his feet.
Bill's son Sam says one of the last times he and his siblings were all together in Wyoming with their dad was for the solar eclipse in 2017.
We went to this little trail next to his house, and we just like dipped our feet in the stream, and it was amazing. The best place to watch. No one there. The shadows were super cool everywhere. It was definitely a very spiritual moment.
Sam says it still doesn't feel real that his dad is gone.
I mean, you always know that your parents are going, that you're going to have to deal with this someday, right? Death is a part of life. But this whole pandemic situation made everything so sudden and rapid and detached and impersonal.
The family hasn't been able to plan any kind of memorial yet. But when the time is right, Bill's wishes were to have a big gathering of family and friends somewhere outside in Wyoming. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
In the next segment, we will hear from family members of three people who died from COVID-19, all in the same day. Also, a discussion about how Wyoming hospitals are faring in this pandemic. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Hospital finances around the nation have been hit hard during the COVID-19 pandemic. This includes Wyoming hospitals, as they had to stop providing the non-essential services that make up a huge percentage of their revenue for a period of time. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska speaks with the president of the Wyoming Hospital Association, Eric Boley, on how hospitals in our state were particularly impacted financially by the pandemic.
They tried to, and they needed to, keep staff in key roles. But when you see a decrease in your revenue of up to 60%, even 70% in some cases, you've got physicians that are used to seeing patients, but the patients aren't coming to the clinics. They aren't utilizing the emergency room. So you've got a lot of people that are relying on that revenue for their income. And then on top of that, you know, we saw an increase in the cost for supplies, PPE supplies, significantly increased because there was a shortage, and then we were having to go to different markets to find that, and we were paying 5 to 10 times higher for masks and other equipment. But I think most importantly is we realize how important our hospital staff members are to us, and their livelihood and the ability for us to recruit and retain trained staff just put a tremendous burden on them. And then they've got, you know, the hospitals have huge fixed overhead costs, expensive equipment and other things that have to be used to be paid for. And when you're not doing elective procedures, you're not doing surgeries, you're not doing diagnostic testing with your medical imaging equipment, and you're not seeing the volume of patients, it couldn't have been a tougher situation.
Right. So how were Wyoming hospitals particularly hit by this that was different from hospitals in New York that actually had COVID-19 surges?
In New York, you know, their hospitals were full to overflowing with coronavirus patients. And while it was difficult for them and they were facing different challenges, at least they knew they had patients that were in their hospitals and that they were going to be paid for the treatment of those patients, because the federal government told us that they'd pay for all those. In Wyoming, you know, we've had very few hospitalizations, and I would venture to guess that maybe only 7 of our hospitals have even had a COVID patient in them. But then you've got your other hospitals, your small critical access hospitals that really rely on the outpatient surgeries and the diagnostic testing and a sustainable volume of patients. They were already in very difficult financial situations, some of them, and then to cut their revenue by 40, 50, 60%, it was a totally different situation than what they're facing in New York. And I don't know which one's worse or which one's better. You know, that New York is facing a huge death toll with their patients and they're full to overflowing, whereas we've got hospitals that are basically sitting empty with huge overhead costs and no patients. And so it was just almost the exact opposite of what we saw in some of the areas that were really hit heavily with coronavirus.
Are you able to say which Wyoming hospital was most affected by this?
Well, they've been affected in different ways. You know, we've had large outbreaks in Fremont County, Wyoming Medical Center, Natrona County right now, and WBI are facing what looks like a surge right now, and so they're treating coronavirus patients. Teton County was another area that was really heavily hit, and that hospital had to take care of quite a few COVID patients. And then here in Cheyenne, at Cheyenne Regional, again, we had hospitalizations. So from treating the patients, you know, those are probably the 4 most heavily hit areas. But on the flip side, when you've got, I would say some of our smaller critical access hospitals have really been impacted more negatively as far as the financial side of things, because they had very thin margins, if any existing margins going into this. And then when you factor in that they don't have any revenue coming in, I think that they've faced some other really difficult challenges that maybe some of the others don't. The nice thing is we've received some of the CARES funding from the federal government. And up until that arrived, I was concerned that some of our hospitals were going to fail and we're going to have to close. And some of them were really considering some really drastic cuts, closing their emergency room and other services because they just couldn't afford to keep them open.
So it sounds like the CARES Act is actually helping hospitals.
In the last distribution of CARES funding that came out to the states, there was a pot of money that went to rural areas specifically. And that was probably the most significant. It impacted all but 2 of our hospitals in the state and brought in relief that without it, I'm sure they would have failed.
So at least for now, all hospitals will be able to stay open?
I think a lot of it has to do with what happens going forward. Depending on what happens in our state with COVID, if we continue to see an escalation, if we continue to see more cases, if it takes longer for the economy to open up, or if we see a resurgence of it in the fall, there are a lot of considerations out there that not just our state, but all the hospitals in every state are trying to figure out is what does the future look like?
Right. So what do you think the future looks like?
you know, everyone, I think, was kind of hopeful that if we flattened the curve and if we did everything that we needed to keep the hospitals from being overrun with coronavirus patients, that everything would be okay. And I do think that what we've done within the state has worked. But now that we're reopening, you know, we've seen a couple of nursing homes in the state now that up until this week, we didn't have any confirmed cases of coronavirus in any of our nursing homes. A lot of people are predicting that there will be another round of COVID in the fall. A lot of it's going to have to do with how people adhere to directives. If they wear their face masks, if they do their social distancing, but the stockpiles are growing and we're going to have better access to supplies. But if we have to continue to curtail all the business side of things, I have some fears about how long our hospitals can maintain doing business the way that everyone expects them to and is used to them doing in all the different communities in our state.
That was Eric Boley of the Wyoming Hospital Association speaking with our own Camila Kudelska. In early March, a few members of the Wheeler family visited a relative at the Showboat Retirement Center in Lander. Days later, it was announced there was a COVID-19 outbreak there. Before long, 14 members of the extended Wheeler family had tested positive for COVID-19, and 5 were hospitalized. On April 20th, the family lost 3 loved ones to the illness. Larry and Gloria Wheeler, who had been married for more than 50 years, passed away hours before their 55-year-old daughter, Dawn Wheeler, also died. Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr asked a dozen relatives to share their memories of Larry, Gloria, and Dawn, and how COVID-19 has taken a toll on the family.
For the past 2 months, kind of been like a big blur since my Aunt Gloria got sick, because she was the first one to get sick out of us all. A week before they got sick, my mom was with Larry and Gloria, so everybody in my household got it.
And I remember texting my mom and asking her how she was doing after I found that out. And she said, I'm pretty sick. It hurts to move, she said to me.
And then when the lockdown happened, my grandparents were already in the hospital. So was my cousin, so was my auntie.
When I first got there, they had to take me through the ICU. And I looked to my left like this, and all I could do was peek. But they wheeled me past all 4 of them, and they were all intubated. Nobody could come in and see them.
I was in there for 26 days, and I was intubated for 10. I guess some people don't remember, but I remember a lot, and it was basically just a really long nightmare, and I couldn't wake up.
And then when it kept going on, and finally I started realizing that we were losing Larry and Gloria. I didn't think we were losing Dawn. I thought Dawn was going to come out of it. It was hard. I got on my knees a lot of times. This is just the ugliest thing a family can go through. And it was really hell, because we couldn't even go to each other's house. I'm Larry Wheeler's younger sister. You know, because of him being my brother, I always seen him as fighting things off. You know, that's the kind of person he was, what he did. And then he told me that when I talked to him the day before he went to the hospital, I called him and I asked him how he was doing. And he said, I told Gloria I can't just lay around and be sick. He said, I need to do something. He says, so I jumped on my truck and went to the mountains.
My dad's always hunted, fished, everything, and they always took us everywhere with them, you know, so we went all over the place with them, the mountains.
Taught me a lot about the outdoors, fishing, hunting, hunting sheds.
I remember when I was young, he would always take me fishing.
He taught me everything about fishing, how to put your hook on, how far to cast, when to start fishing in a lake, fishing in a river.
And Gloria was our cook. Knew how to cook game meat.
Like deer, and she knew how to cook it real good. She knew how to cook the fish real good.
When we'd come home with our fish, Grandma would already be ready. She would already have everything to fry those fish up. She would already have her sides ready.
I think they were married 53 years. Was it 52 or 53? He would always go out as a teenager, go out, and they were always together going down to the river. He was always fishing then too, and she would be there with him. That's kind of like how they met. You know, I hardly remember, but I remember her being pregnant, and I remember Larry announcing it to us. And he came in and he said, hey, Gloria's going to have a baby. My brother, we were just little kids, me and my other brother. We were kind of young and naive, I guess. And my brother said, is it yours? Because we were young, you know. You mean you're going to have a baby too? It's you and her? And he just looked at my brother and he said, yeah, it's mine. But that's when they had their baby together, and he was real proud of it. Dawn, she came into the world, I remember her. She was just a big, cute baby.
I guess kind of the way we were raised, we didn't cuss around them, we didn't smoke around, we didn't do anything. And my mom was real strict.
You know, they still parented us all the way up until they were gone. They still got after us. I'm glad they did, because they had us to where we knew what respect was, and we respected them.
I've got to know my mother really well after my marriage. She was always there for me when I needed advice on a lot of stuff that was going on in my life. And down through the years, she became my best friend. And same with Larry, my stepdad. When I went for a visit, he came to me. He said, Charla, whenever you need a place to stay, this home is always open for you. You don't have to worry about anything. And I've always held that close to my heart because I knew Larry cared for me.
When we were younger, me and my cousins, we got together in a choir, and my mom was like telling us what we can do and what we can't do, how to walk in our heels and everything. Dawn, you know, she's kind of soft-spoken. Her voice is softer. So they would get her to sing all the high songs. But they were really pretty. I wished we could have recorded them, or, you know, but they were real pretty songs, and she, you know, she had a real pretty voice.
Oh, Auntie Dawn. Auntie Dawn was the sweetest, kind soul, just like her mama.
Nancy was a pretty good artist. Every time I'd see her, she would always give me some sort of painting.
She would paint something and she would just give it away. She'd be like, oh, I made this for you.
She would always be reading her Bible, or she would say something out of the Bible, you know, coming from the Bible. She would share that with me.
Dawn is my cousin, but she's more like my sister. Growing up, she always took care of her, like us younger girls and our brothers.
My sister Dawn, she loved babies. She would just get them from your arms and just carry them around, you know, and she just baby them.
My Auntie Dawn, she was very, very close with one of my daughters. She always went out of her way to get them gifts and snacks and everything all the time. She was probably their favorite grandma.
After she had Ashley, like, all of her time was with her daughter, and they were, like, best friends.
Dawn is my mom. She was quiet, but she had a lot of love in her. She was really caring. She was really gentle. She was my favorite person. I really miss her. Larry and Gloria were my grandparents, and they were basically like my other parents. They cared about everyone. They adored everyone, you know, the whole family. And everybody looked up to them. Everybody really loved them. And
I think everybody just feels lost.
Grandma and Grandpa's house was our safe haven.
We would always meet there, and food will be cooking. We would all be around the table visiting and laughing, and there was always laughter in that house.
My grandma, she was always kind of the matriarch, the go-to person, whether it be for prayer or, you know, advice, or just a shoulder to lean on and to talk to.
Grandma, like, knew how to turn everything right. Just a phone call.
They did everything they could for their grandkids and their great-grandkids. They did everything for everybody in this family.
They were the elders in our family. And it's like, what are we going to do now? The Creator let them go together. And they even waited for Dawn. And they took Dawn, you know, before the day was over, they took her with. So it was all in, you know, God was in control all that time. And to me, the way I can look at it, to get some comfort, is Larry and Gloria and Dawn sacrificed for everybody to look and to start changing their ways and to see how serious this virus is. And, you know, they didn't go in vain.
Those were the voices of the extended Wheeler family, remembering Larry, Gloria, and Dawn Wheeler. This piece was produced by Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr. When we come back, national parks have opened up this week. We will hear how they might proceed in the world of coronavirus. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Grand Teton and Yellowstone National Parks partially reopened this week, and visitors from around the country are flocking to the celebrated destinations. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim speaks with Joan Anselmo. She's a 35-year veteran of the National Park Service and currently a Wyoming resident. They discuss the challenges and opportunities of reopening the parks during a global pandemic, especially as Memorial Day weekend is upon us.
I think it's going to be very challenging, and it will be situational, meaning it will be specific to the individual park and to the communities that are adjacent to a national park, and what the public health officials in the adjacent communities think is working and perhaps not working so well. Right now, Yellowstone is opening in phases, and it's just slowly opening the lower loop, the lower portion of Yellowstone, and visitors are, as I understand it, are being asked to only come for the day and to be pretty self-sufficient, so that, you know, bringing your food and anything that you're going to need, warm clothing, water, etc., because facilities are not really open by and large. And it will be those gateway communities outside of any of the parks that will be supporting visitors who are trying to have an experience very different, perhaps, than in previous years.
I've heard in some instances that staffing, as you said, maybe still a little short. You know, I think some concerns I've heard is that how congestion will be handled, especially in communities that don't necessarily have a ton of space, and out-of-staters too, coming in to Wyoming, especially while it starts to get warmer. Are any of those concerns that you've heard about or see being handled?
Yes, I've certainly heard those concerns, and this is something new that the agency has never had to face before in any of its modern history. So it's sort of by trial and error. Clearly, the public is anxious and looking forward to getting back into the parks to experience America's wonderful national parks. So there's a lot of reason to see visitors come flooding back in, but the crowding is a concern. Access to public restrooms is certainly going to be an issue for some people. And I think it's going to be a day by day. How is it going? How is it working? Are there challenges? What's working well? What's maybe not working? And most importantly, will people be respectful and protecting themselves and each other by wearing masks?
Yeah, and it does, like you said, come down so much to just people making the right call.
I think that one trial that might be good to experiment with would be making day reservations right now. I think that if the parks were to experiment with a reservation system, so that while they're opening in these slower phases, whether they would be able to reserve ahead and sort of control the spacing of people. It's a challenge in a place as large as Yellowstone and Grand Teton, but perhaps there could be ways to experiment with advanced reservations to even come for a day visit.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim speaking with former National Park Service employee Joan Anselmo. The Riven Country of Senga Munro tells the story of a herbal healer who tragically loses her daughter. Most of the story is set in contemporary northeastern Wyoming, where the book's author, Renee Carrier, has lived for more than 32 years. She tells Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler why that matters.
I said it here because that's what came to me. And in a state as rural as Wyoming, I believe our stories are somehow more concentrated, don't you find? Like the proverbial hero's journey tale, it stands more of a chance, you know, in these epic landscapes. You know, Senga would say, yes, even the flora and the fauna are characters and should be mentioned as thus, because it's, you know, we're all connected. Not to get too airy-fairy about it, but it's all of one piece. And when you're writing, I think it, you know, especially if what you're writing you consider literary fiction, you can get away with assigning, you know, these roles to entities and such.
And so in the story, you play with time. It's very interesting. You kind of start with one of the biggest events that, you know, carries through the rest of the story. What made you decide to, you know, you incorporate flashbacks and kind of play with time in that way?
Well, I needed to have a origin story for Senga. The way the story begins gets you right into her defining event of her life. And it's no secret, it's the death of her daughter. So I wanted to just do that and then go to flashbacks as to what led up to it, and then I pick up the thread again and go on. But it needed to be said right from the get-go, I thought. The reader needs to also understand, you know, Senga's psychology, you know, as to why she maybe had so much trouble with this. And it's not so much a flashback, because it's more like the what happens in the first chapter is a flash forward, and then I start, you know, with her granny, and I wanted to give granny, her grandmother, due time, because she's such an important part of Senga's psyche.
And I guess jumping off that point, grief and loss is, like, you know, a huge part of this. Is there anything in your own life that really drew you to kind of analyze and kind of, you know, work on this idea?
Well, I would see grief, for one thing, very much tied to time, because they say, you know, well, you'll get better in time. Well, I don't believe that's how time works. I don't see it as linear myself. I think everything's always happening at the same time, and just as being humans, we have to, you know, figure out how to deal with that. But grief and loss are tough subjects to deal with in a novel. People don't sometimes like reading about it, but they're, and given the news cycle today especially, but it's my belief and a fervent hope that stories are anodynes against pain, and that they can offer solace and ultimately for Senga a sense of purpose and agency.
And this is book one of a series, and you said you're working on the third right now, so the second is finished.
I'm finished with all three of them. I'm formatting the third right now, but I'm working on the fourth one is a work in progress, plus another nonfiction project I've got going. So I'm really grateful for it.
Renee Carrier is the author of The Riven Country of Sangam and Roe, which is out now. Thank you so much, Renee, for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you, Catherine.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. This show and individual segments can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. You can also get our stories on social media, including Facebook. Anna Rader is our web editor. Never miss an episode by signing up for our podcast. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.